Odyssey celebrates Veterans Day, brought to you by T-Mobile. You can count on T-Mobile to help you stay connected on America's largest 5G network.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
8:14 now, Monday morning, September 9th, the day after the Saints' big victory yesterday, 2 days after LSU's victory over Nicholls State, and 2 days before we're supposed to be impacted by this storm down in the Gulf. Jeff Palermo, and we'll give you the latest on that throughout the morning. Jeff Palermo joins us now, our friend, WWL.com, Louisiana Network News Director. How you doing, Jeff?
Doing well, Tommy. How are you doing?
I am okay, sir. Tell me about the LSU-Nicholls game.
Well, I think it was a lot closer than most people expected. Nicholls, I mean, they were within 2 points there in the third quarter after Colin Guggenheim, who, one of my favorite high school football players that I had a chance to cover. He was the quarterback at John Curtis, and he's really developed into a really good running back for the Nicholls Colonels, busted off a long touchdown run. Well, it's a hard game to gauge, Tommy, because, and I know fans don't really want to hear about excuses, but you geared up for the season opener against USC. You played that game on a Sunday night. You got back into Baton Rouge Monday morning at 5 a.m., and then you have to play a team that's in a lower division. You're going up against a Nicholls team where most of the kids that are on that team are from Louisiana, dreamed of playing in Tiger Stadium, are sky high for the game, and LSU is a bit flat. And you get performances like what you saw in the first 30 minutes of that game. But that still doesn't excuse the fact that LSU allowed Colin Guggenheim to have a big night running the football. LSU once again had trouble running the football, even though Coach Brian Kelly said, hey, we checked out of a lot of run calls to go to pass because they are crowding the box. But still, someone like Caleb Jackson, you were hoping would kind of find his footing, was unable to do that. It's clear LSU can throw the football. Big game once again from Garrett Nussmeier, 6 touchdown passes. But probably the biggest storyline from the game for me, Tommy, is the loss of Jacobian Guillory. Mm-hmm. Tore his Achilles tendon in the game, out for the year. It's at a position that, frankly, they can't afford to have any major injuries. And they really, if you thought about it before the season, if there was one guy on defense that you could have ill afford to lose, it was him.
He was the best defensive tackle they had, pretty much.
Yes, and had the most experience. Even though he only had a handful of starts during his career, he's played a lot at LSU. So now you got a lot of inexperience there, and it's going to be a huge concern.
And did you say it's a torn Achilles?
Yeah, torn Achilles tendon. Yeah, so that's it for him. So just a brutal loss for LSU defensively.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between excuses and reasons. I honestly do.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And I think in this case, and look, I understand LSU fans, but a big part of this is what you just said about, you know, you got the big opener against USC. You're all geared up for that. Then you don't get back until 5 o'clock on Monday morning,
right,
which really does throw all of the circadian rhythms off and everything else. Then you got to get everybody rested. You still got to get practiced. Coaches got to get game plans in and everything else. So all that work continues. I know they have a lot of help. I get all of that.
Yes.
But
yes,
when it comes to running the ball, I think specifically offensive line play, I think that has a lot to do with will and determination and being fired up or not. And I think also it is kind of hard for LSU as a team, and Brian Kelly took ownership of this, saying he's got to coach him better. But I think it's hard to get a team to go from that to get geared, given the travel considerations and everything else, get geared up to play Nicholls. No disrespect, don't you think?
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. And you could try to coach it up, you could try to talk it up as much as you want as a coaching staff. But hey, you go back even to the 2019 season, right? Greatest LSU football team ever. They struggled for a half against Western Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I mean, it happens. It happens. But there are some things you can pick out of that game, And Coach Brian Kelly talked about it afterwards, about dominating at the line of scrimmage, that they need to start doing that and allowing a team like Nichols to run the ball as well as they did, especially in the first half and then that long run by Guggenheim, and then LSU's inability to run the football. We have now seen that here for eight quarters when it comes to LSU football. There is no doubt that this LSU offensive line, which was missing one of its starters on Saturday night, Dellinger did not play, but there is no doubt that this LSU offensive line is probably the best pass-protecting offensive line in the country. I mean, Nussmeier has been barely touched through two games this season. But what we have seen, and it's pretty much the same offensive line that we saw last year, and even last year, it could not develop really a traditional running game. And so we've seen it for a long time here, and they have not been able to do that. It's been a very disappointing start to the season for Caleb Jackson, for a guy that a lot of people expected to really have a huge season this year. And he's averaging, I think, less than 3 yards a carry. So these are things that they'll be working on this week as they get ready for the SEC opener against South Carolina.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We'll come back talking to Jeff Palermo. I do think when it comes to not the skill positions, but when it comes to line play, both defensive and offensive, so much of that, Jeff, do you agree or not, is about state of mind and about imposing your will and being in the right frame of mind and being – you understand what I'm trying to say?
Well, I know going into the USC game, they talked a big game. They seemed like they were in the state of mind that they wanted to dominate USC, and I'm talking about LSU's offensive line. And they went into that game thinking they could dominate the Trojans at the line of scrimmage, and they did not. There is some talent that comes into play here, some technique. There is just something that they're lacking when it comes to not being able to really just dominate the line of scrimmage when it comes to running the football.
That is a good point as well. 820 traffic now,
Odyssey celebrates Veterans Day, brought to you by T-Mobile. You can count on T-Mobile to help you stay connected on America's largest 5G network.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
UL 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director, about LSU's game. And look, ABC is and ESPN and Disney are having it out with DirecTV and UVerse, and I don't care about any of that, but I'm telling you right now, I'm getting ready to just unplug the entire damn thing and just put rabbit ears up. I am, Jeff. I'm just let everybody know that.
Yep. You can always listen to the game at WWL Radio.
Well, yeah, and I think it's going to be on ABC, right?
Yes, it will be on ABC. College Game Day will be there too, which kind of gives you an idea of how light of a football weekend it is schedule for college football. I mean, LSU and a South Carolina team that is kind of a meh team in the Southeastern Conference.
Yeah, let's look ahead of that. What can you tell me about South Carolina?
Well, South Carolina did have an impressive win. I mean, they blew out Kentucky, played outstanding defense, forced some turnovers. Really good win for Shane Beamer's team at South Carolina. And they've had some good wins with Shane Beamer as the head coach there. They've pulled off some good victories, but they're not. I think I saw today LSU's favored by 6.5 or so, a touchdown favorite going into this game. So it's not – I mean, LSU should be able to go in there and win. I mean, South Carolina didn't look very good in its opener, but they did rebound and played really well, inspired football against Kentucky. So it's not going to be an easy task. I think it's maybe if you want to look at it glass half full, Tommy, probably good that they struggled against Nichols, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's going to be a little more – even more attention to detail – based on the fact that they didn't play very well in that first half. And I think it comes down to a lot of what we were talking about in the first segment, and that is whether LSU will have the ability to control the line of scrimmage against the Gamecocks.
See, now that is going to be the prover right there, because, okay, maybe USC was better on a defensive front than we thought, all right? So that being the case, and if you're going to say that they were tired on Saturday night and not really up for Nichols, however you want to say it, well, then maybe we get a real feel for it this Saturday. Thoughts?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I think you get a better idea. It's going to be, you know, there's going to be some challenges for this week as well. Obviously, we got a hurricane that's coming to Louisiana.
Tell me about that. I wanted to ask you about that. Thank you, Jeff, because I got so many things on my mind. It kind of slipped with getting ready for the next weather segment. How, you know, can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah,
tell me
right.
about that with preparations.
Well, I would imagine, you know, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. I think that hopefully the 10 o'clock update from the National Hurricane Center gives us a little bit more of an idea. But, you know, Wednesday could be a potential day where, you know, they'll maybe practice in the morning and then hunker down for the day. They should be able to fly out with no problem. The storm will be out of here by the time Friday rolls around. They should be able to fly out and all that. I think it's mainly going to change preparation Wednesday and Thursday. And then obviously the big factor is power outages, right? You just hope you don't have a bunch of players that are living in apartments that don't have any power. But then again, look at LSU's Football Operations Center. You can spend a night there.
Yeah,
better than a five-star hotel for most people.
I guess those places, I was going to ask you that, are they generator powered or whatever? Because
you would think that
the LSU players having to live without power. I don't know how many of them are married, have family.
Right.
I don't know anything about that because some of them have been in school 15, 20 years. You know, some of them, they get a gold watch when they retire. They don't get a diploma. But the point I'm making is you would think that would be a minimal distraction. You would hope at least.
You would hope, but it is going to be a challenge. But getting back to that South Carolina defense, five sacks, intercepted a couple passes against Kentucky. Big win for them. And so LSU's offense, can they run the ball? We know they can throw it with Nussmeier, but, man, Brian Kelly continues to look for that complimentary offense.
Let's hope they put it all together. Thank you, Jeff. Stay safe. We'll talk to you soon.
You too, Tommy.
Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Quick break. Come back. Talk to Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, about maybe charging parents as a way to stop school shootings. News, weather, more now with WWL First News. At 8:39 to the National Weather Service, we go to talk to Sean O'Neill, meteorologist. How you doing, Sean?
Hey, Tommy. Good morning.
Have you traced your people back to the old sod?
I'm sorry?
Have you traced your people back to the old sod, to Ireland? I'm just wondering what county.
I'm not sure exactly, but yeah, definitely from Ireland.
All right, good. Let's talk about the storm and what the latest is. How often are we going to get updated on this thing, et cetera?
Well, we're getting constant updates at this point. Recon aircraft's out there right now checking the storm, see if we have a closed circulation center yet. Obviously, at that point, it would get a name, would be a tropical storm based on the winds that, you know, have been already reported out there. We're just kind of waiting to see some of that data. Things will start to come into a little better focus as we get some of that here today.
Is this close enough where radar will tell you what you need to know as much as the hurricane hunters or not?
No, it's a little far out, and it's a little too far south right now. So, like, even the radar in Brownsville isn't really quite, you know, picking it up yet at this point.
So what do we need to know right now for the people living all the way from Lafayette, let's say, to New Orleans?
Well, I mean, today is already, you know, we're already now in that phase where it's preparation time. You know, with it developing so close, you know, to home, you know at this point that there's probably going to be some impact. So it's already time to start those preparations and make sure you have everything under control as far as, you know, what you need to do. and we just need to watch. Today's, again, going to be a big day as far as some of this stuff coming into a little more focus, and we'll be able to pinpoint some more of the details on, you know, wind speeds and rainfall and some of that stuff as we go out through the day today. But you know, really the whole state is under the gun right now and needs to be doing everything to get prepared for a storm.
What would you advise people to do? Pick up stuff outside the house? You're talking about wind problems here. Make sure the storm drains are clean, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Everybody knows, you know, the typical stuff we need to do, you know, make sure you get your supplies, make sure you, you know, hopefully a lot of people have already done those kinds of things, but, you know, make sure you have everything that you need. This is the kind of situation, you know, where you might have people at this point, you know, staying for the most part. So again, make sure you have everything you need, you know, especially in a situation where there'll be power outages and stuff like that. So, I think everybody around here has been through it enough times that they know what to do. It's time to put those plans into action.
And time frame, Sean, would be?
Would be Wednesday and Thursday. So, you know, Wednesday afternoon into Wednesday evening, it would start to approach the coast and weather would already start to deteriorate. So really, you have today and tomorrow.
All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Sean O'Neill, meteorologist with the National Weather Service. It was on this date, as a matter of fact, back in 1965. Hurricane Betsy hit Grand Isle. That's where it made landfall and eventually flooded a lot of the city. And they built the storm protection system, which worked until 2005, as we all know, with Katrina. And Betsy killed 75 people in Louisiana. So it is a date of infamy as far as hurricanes go. I don't think this is going to be anything like that at all, but we will keep it. The last thing in the world I want to do is worry anybody or get them scared, but I don't want to leave you ill-prepared either. So just pay attention and, I guess, fill up the tank with gas and be prepared in case the power goes out. We'll take a break. Come back, talk to Dane Cialino, WWO. 8:47, I get a text here about school closures in the area on Wednesday. Nobody's decided anything on that yet. I would imagine they'd wait to see what happens today and what they find out. And I know it's a pain, but what can we do but wait and watch? Dane Cialino joins us now, our friend, a little bit late because we wanted to give you an update on the weather. Professor of Law at Loyola. Good morning, Dane. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. Great.
You know, whenever something happens with juvenile crime in the city, people text me and say, well, why don't they hold their parents responsible? And that's happened in Michigan earlier this year with a school shooting with parents being convicted. First time, as I understand it. Take me through, because you can't just do stuff, right? You got to have the legal precedent or you got to have the laws in place to prosecute people for crimes. When it comes to school shootings, explain, if you can, Dane, what happened in Michigan, and is the same thing apply in Georgia? Is it state law, and could this maybe be a remedy? And I know that would be speculation on your part, but toward maybe parents being a little bit more concerned with their guns and kids and maybe a way to stop at least lessen school shootings.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real problem. I just checked the crime stats on this. Last year, there were 125,000 incidents of juvenile violent crime, murders and assaults and robberies and those sorts of things. And, of course, rarely are parents criminally prosecuted for the acts of their children. But we've seen it as recently as last week, and that's why we're having this call in Georgia and a few months ago in Michigan. It's these high profile cases that seem to draw the ire of prosecutors rather than the steady, relentless flow of violent cases that routinely happen every year, which is odd, but here we are. From a legal standpoint, there are some states that have laws that require parents to keep guns under lock and key away from children. Of course, those laws are typically designed to protect children from negligent firearm accidents, not from committing intentional homicides and assaults. But those laws exist. Oddly enough, they don't exist in Georgia. So what the prosecutor's doing in Georgia is really, at least in my view, really stretching the law, trying to turn a case of alleged negligence where the father should have known of the risk presented by his son, but didn't.
At 8:39 to the National Weather Service, we go to talk to Sean O'Neill, meteorologist. How you doing, Sean?
Hey, Tommy. Good morning.
Have you traced your people back to the old sod?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, have you traced your people back to the old sod, to Ireland? I'm just wondering what county.
Oh, yeah, not sure exactly, but yeah, definitely from Ireland.
All right, good. Let's talk about the storm and what the latest is. How often are we going to get updated on this thing, et cetera?
Well, we're getting constant updates at this point. Recon aircraft's out there right now checking the storm, see if we have a closed circulation center yet. Obviously, at that point, it would get a name, would be a tropical storm based on the winds that, you know, have been already reported out there. We're just kind of waiting to see some of that data. Things will start to come into a little better focus as we get some of that here today.
Is this close enough where radar will tell you what you need to know as much as the hurricane hunters or not?
No, it's a little far out, and it's a little too far south right now. So, like, even the radar in Brownsville isn't really quite, you know, picking it up yet at this point.
So what do we need to know right now for the people living all the way from Lafayette, let's say, to New Orleans?
Well, I mean, today is already, you know, we're already now in that phase where it's preparation time. You know, with it developing so close, you know, to home, you know at this point that there's probably going to be some impact. So it's already time to start those preparations and make sure you have everything under control as far as, you know, what you need to do. and we just need to watch. Today's, again, going to be a big day as far as some of this stuff coming into a little more focus, and we'll be able to pinpoint some more of the details on, you know, wind speeds and rainfall and some of that stuff as we go out through the day today. But you know, really the whole state is under the gun right now and needs to be doing everything to get prepared
so
for a storm.
What would you advise people to do? Pick up stuff outside the house? You're talking about wind problems here. Make sure the storm drains are clean, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Everybody knows, you know, the typical stuff we need to do, you know, make sure you get your supplies, make sure you know, hopefully a lot of people have already done those kinds of things, but, you know, make sure you have everything that you need. This is the kind of situation, you know, where you might have people at this point, you know, staying for the most part. So again, make sure you have everything you need, you know, especially in a situation where there'll be power outages and stuff like that. So I think everybody around here has been through it enough times that they know what to do. It's time to put those plans into action.
And time frame, Sean, would be
Wednesday and Thursday. So, you know, Wednesday afternoon into Wednesday evening, it would start to approach the coast and weather would already start to deteriorate. So really you have today and tomorrow.
All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Sean O'Neill, meteorologist with the National Weather Service. It was on this date, as a matter of fact, back in 1965, Hurricane Betsy hit Grand Isle. That's where it made landfall and eventually flooded a lot of the city. And they built the storm protection system, which worked until 2005, as we all know, with Katrina. And Betsy killed 75 people in Louisiana. So it is a date of infamy as far as hurricanes go. I don't think this is going to be anything like that at all, but we will keep it. The last thing in the world I want to do is worry anybody or get them scared, but I don't want to leave you ill-prepared either. So just pay attention and, I guess, fill up the tank with gas and be prepared in case the power goes out. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Dane Cialino, WWL. 8:47, I get a text here about school closures in the area on Wednesday. Nobody's decided anything on that yet. I would imagine they'd wait to see what happens today and what they find out. And I know it's a pain, but what can we do but wait and watch? Dane Cialino joins us now, our friend, a little bit late because we wanted to give you an update on the weather. Professor of Law at Loyola. Good morning, Dane. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. Great.
You know, whenever something happens with juvenile crime in the city, people text me and say, well, why don't they hold their parents responsible? And that's happened in Michigan earlier this year with a school shooting with parents being convicted. First time, as I understand it. Take me through, because you can't just do stuff, right? You got to have the legal precedent or you got to have the laws in place to prosecute people for crimes. When it comes to school shootings, explain, if you can, Dane, what happened in Michigan, and is the same thing apply in Georgia? Is it state law, and could this maybe be a remedy? And I know that would be speculation on your part, but toward maybe parents being a little bit more concerned with their guns and kids and maybe a way to stop at least lessen school shootings.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real problem. I just checked the crime stats on this. Last year, there were 125,000 incidents of juvenile violent crime, murders and assaults and robberies and those sorts of things. And, of course, rarely are parents criminally prosecuted for the acts of their children. But we've seen it as recently as last week, and that's why we're having this call in Georgia and a few months ago in Michigan. It's these high-profile cases that
that seemed to draw the ire of prosecutors rather than the steady, relentless flow of violent cases that routinely happen every year, which is odd, but here we are. From a legal standpoint, there are some states that have laws that require parents to keep guns under lock and key away from children. Of course, those laws are typically designed to protect children from negligent firearm accidents, not from committing intentional homicides and assaults. But those laws exist. Oddly enough, they don't exist in Georgia. So what the prosecutor's doing in Georgia is really, at least in my view, really stretching the law, trying to turn a case of alleged negligence where the father should have known of the risk presented by his son, but didn't, into a murder case. And that father has been charged with second degree murder. And it's essentially a bootstrapping. It's a homicide that was caused in connection with child endangerment, which is a crime of negligence. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds on the criminal law theory on this, but typically we want to make sure that we're sending the right messages with criminal law. We typically prosecute people for murder when they've intentionally killed another human being or at least been engaged in some sort of dangerous, violent felony like robbery and a human being dies. When you take a crime of negligence like child endangerment and then you use that to bootstrap into a murder indictment, that I think is a bit concerning.
So tell me how it differs from the Michigan case.
Well, it doesn't differ in the Michigan case. It does in some respects, because the Michigan parents were charged with involuntary manslaughter, which in Louisiana we would call negligent homicide, mm-hmm. where they were charged with homicide resulting from their own criminal negligence that they should have known their son was dangerous and they should have done something to prevent these violent acts. What's different in that was not a murder prosecution. It was a manslaughter prosecution, a criminally negligent homicide prosecution. This case in Georgia, the prosecutors really ramped it up by charging the father with murder, second degree murder. And to me, again, that sends the message, the wrong message, that it kind of cheapens the crime of murder when you charge merely negligent people with it.
So according to New York Times, the Secret Service did some studies, and they've determined about 3/4 of the guns used in school shootings were taken from the home of the perpetrator's parents or a close relative. As it relates to applying the same theory to juvenile street crimes, if you want to call it that, to distinguish from school shootings, the difference would be, I don't know that in those cases that they're using the guns of the parents or the relatives, and that is an important distinction as opposed to being responsible for what your juvenile does?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm not sure I've seen any stats on where the firearms used in juvenile firearms crimes were procured by the child. But that could be a distinction that makes some difference. But again, keep in mind that school shootings, although they make national news when they happen, are a very, very small percentage of violent crime committed by juveniles. And it is odd that we direct all of our efforts toward those very few lightning strikes and essentially ignore the hundreds of thousands of other incidents that happen every year in inner cities. And we don't try to do anything about holding parents responsible in those situations.
And that is what I was trying to ask
right.
I guess, Dane, is that is it about the ownership of the gun or is it about the behavior of the student and of the child and the responsibility of the parent as far as the behavior goes or about, I guess, keeping the gun safe?
Well, I think it's mostly about the sensationalist media attention being given to school shootings. I mean, they're horrible, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of horrible, violent crime happening all over America every day by juveniles, and that doesn't get the media attention.
But is there a legal way that the government could go after parents if it's not their guns that are being used, I guess is what I'm asking?
Yeah, because the you could use exactly the same theories that are being used, that were used in Michigan and that are being used in Georgia. Those charges aren't firearm dependent in any respect. So if prosecutors were really concerned with holding parents accountable, there is a lot of opportunities to do that in I hate to say it, but routine type of violent crimes that are that happen every day in big cities all throughout the United States. And it's odd that they just pick the ones, a few isolated incidents that happen to get a lot of media scrutiny and attention, and focus on those parents while not on many, many others.
Very interesting, Dane. I love picking your brain. I appreciate your time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tommy.
You have a good day. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, 855 Traffic Now, WWL. I got a text here about school closures in the area on Wednesday. Nobody's decided anything on that yet. I would imagine they'd wait to see what happens today and what they find out. And I know it's a pain, but what can we do but wait and watch? Dane Cialino joins us now, our friend, a little bit late because we wanted to give you an update on the weather. Professor of Law at Loyola. Good morning, Dane. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. Great.
You know, whenever something happens with juvenile crime in the city, people text me and say, well, why don't they hold their parents responsible? And that's happened in Michigan earlier this year with a school shooting with parents being convicted. First time, as I understand it. Take me through, because you can't just do stuff, right? You got to have the legal precedent, or you got to have the laws in place to prosecute people for crimes. When it comes to school shootings, explain, if you can, Dane, what happened in Michigan, and is the same thing apply in Georgia? Is it state law, and could this maybe be a remedy? And I know that would be speculation on your part, but toward maybe parents being a little bit more concerned with their guns and kids, and maybe a way to stop at least lessen school shootings.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real problem. I just checked the crime stats on this. Last year, there were 125,000 incidents of juvenile violent crime, murders and assaults and robberies and those sorts of things. And, of course, rarely are parents criminally prosecuted for the acts of their children. But we've seen it as recently as last week, and that's why we're having this call, in Georgia and a few months ago in Michigan. It's these high profile cases that seem to draw the ire of prosecutors rather than the steady, relentless flow of violent cases that routinely happen every year, which is odd, but here we are. From a legal standpoint, there are some states that have laws that require parents to keep guns under lock and key away from children. Of course, those laws are typically designed to protect children from negligent firearm accidents, not from committing intentional homicides and assaults. Those laws exist. Oddly enough, they don't exist in Georgia. So what the prosecutor's doing in Georgia is really, at least in my view, really stretching the law, trying to turn a case of alleged negligence where the father should have known of the risk presented by his son but didn't, into a murder case. And that father has been charged with second-degree murder. And it's essentially a bootstrapping. It's a homicide that was caused in connection with child endangerment, which is a crime of negligence. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds on the criminal law theory on this, but typically we want to make sure that we're sending the right messages with criminal law. We typically prosecute people for murder when they've intentionally killed another human being, or at least been engaged in some sort of dangerous, violent felony like robbery, and a human being dies. When you take a crime of negligence like child endangerment and then you use that to bootstrap into a murder indictment, that I think is a bit concerning.
So tell me how it differs from the Michigan case.
Well, it doesn't differ. In the Michigan
case,
those
parents.
It does in some respects, because the Michigan parents were charged with involuntary manslaughter, which in Louisiana we would call negligent homicide, mm-hmm. where they were charged with homicide resulting from their own criminal negligence that they should have known their son was dangerous and they should have done something to prevent these violent acts. What's different in that was not a murder prosecution. It was a manslaughter prosecution, a criminally negligent homicide prosecution. This case in Georgia, the prosecutors really ramped it up by charging the father with murder, second degree murder. And to me, again, that sends the message, the wrong message, that it kind of cheapens the crime of murder when you charge merely negligent people with it.
So according to New York Times, the Secret Service did some studies and they've determined about 3/4 of the guns used in school shootings were taken from the home of the perpetrator's parents or a close relative. As it relates to applying the same theory to juvenile street crimes, if you want to call it that, to distinguish from school shootings, the difference would be, I don't know that in those cases that they're using the guns of the parents or the relatives, and that is an important distinction as opposed to being responsible for what your juvenile does?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm not sure I've seen any stats on where the firearms used in juvenile firearms crimes were procured by the child. But that could be a distinction that makes some difference. But again, keep in mind that school shootings, although they make national news when they happen, are a very, very small percentage of violent crime committed by juveniles. And it is odd that we direct all of our efforts toward those very few lightning strikes and essentially ignore the hundreds of thousands of other incidents that happen every year in inner cities. And we don't try to do anything about holding parents responsible in those situations.
And that is what I was trying to ask
right.
I guess, Dane, is it about the ownership of the gun or is it about the behavior of the student and of the child and the responsibility of the parent as far as the behavior goes or about, keeping the gun safe?
Well, I think it's mostly about the sensationalist media attention being given to school shootings. I mean, they're horrible, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of horrible, violent crime happening all over America every day by juveniles, and that doesn't get the media attention.
But is there a legal way that the government could go after parents if it's not their guns that are being used, I guess is what I'm asking?
Yeah, because you could use exactly the same theories that are being used that were used in Michigan and that are being used in Georgia. Those charges aren't firearm dependent in any respect. So if prosecutors were really concerned with holding parents accountable, there is a lot of opportunities to do that in I hate to say it, but routine type of violent crimes that happen every day in big cities all throughout the United States. And it's odd that they just pick the ones, a few isolated incidents that happen to get a lot of media scrutiny and attention and focus on those parents while not on many, many others.
Very interesting, Dane. I love picking your brain. I appreciate your time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tommy.
Have a good day. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, 855 Traffic Now, WWL.
Odyssey celebrates Veterans Day, brought to you by T-Mobile. You can count on T-Mobile to help you stay connected on America's largest 5G network.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.